This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for November 25th, 2013. As federal tax developments go, it was not a particularly disappointing week, starting with an internal legal memorandum dealing with a company in Alaska that attempted to change its method of accounting to accelerate significant deductions beyond that which the law allows. Then the IRS's release of an updated publication 4483, Tax Sheltered Annuity Plans, which explains how to avoid additional taxes and penalties for sponsors of such plans. Then a tax court summary opinion denying deductions to two individuals who spent money preparing a rental property for rent in 2008, but did not actually rent it in 2008, which meant that those expenses, which might have been otherwise deductible, were in fact startup costs. Then an attempted deduction for qualified conservation contribution by a New York partnership with a lot of fancy help and an expensive appraisal failed because the qualified conservation easement requirements were not met, in that the contribution failed to meet the exclusivity requirement because the restriction did not preserve the entire exterior of the structure. It's a very interesting decision, 61 York acquisition. We're going to talk about that one at some length. Then a very unusual application of 263 Cap A requiring City Line Candy and Tobacco Corporation to treat its tobacco stamps, tax stamp costs, as indirect handling costs to be capitalized with its inventory of cigarettes. Then a corporation that attempted to accelerate deductions beyond that which the law allows, another corporation attempting to accelerate deductions beyond that which the law allows, but this time through a request for an accounting method change, which the corporation went all the way to a tax court to defend and was defeated. And then finally, in what should be a wake-up call for all CPA firms, a Kentucky court has ordered Grant Thornton to pay $100 million in damages for the sale of a bogus tax shelter. You'll hear more about that, of course, at the close of the program. That's the last item that comes up this week. So, as they say in broadcasting, stay tuned. Our first item is that internal legal memorandum which dealt with a taxpayer attempting to deduct commission expense twice. The IRS determined that an employer did not change its method of accounting for purposes of Section 446E when it stopped deducting commission expenses twice and begins to deduct those expenses only once. Now, that proposition on its face is rather startling. Let's see how the memo progresses. The facts are that the employer pays commissions to its employees once, but deducts the commissions twice for federal income tax purposes. First, the employer claims a deduction at the time its employees earn the commissions as an accrual basis taxpayer. Later, the employer deducts the amount of the commissions when they are paid to the employees. So the practice has been to take two deductions rather than one. Regulation 1.446-1A1 defines the term method of accounting to include not only the overall method of accounting of a taxpayer, but also the taxpayer's accounting treatment of any item of gross income or deduction. Under Regulation 1.446-1E2ib, however, a change in accounting method does not include an adjustment of any item of income or deduction that does not involve the proper time for the inclusion of the item of income or the taking of a deduction, such as correction of items that are deducted as business expenses but are in fact personal expenses. In considering whether a taxpayer changes its accounting method under Section 446, the IRS uses the so-called lifetime income test. Under that test, if the change from a current accounting practice to another accounting, the change from a current accounting practice to another accounting practice constitutes a change in accounting method only if the current and proposed accounting practices would result in the same amounts of cumulative income over the lifetime of the taxpayer. The IRS concluded, Rightly, in this situation, that since deducting the commissions paid by the employer once instead of twice will permanently affect the employer's lifetime income, the change in the employer's accounting practice is not a change in accounting method. Now, that means it is not protected by any of the automatic accounting method change provisions. So where does that leave this taxpayer confronting an IRS examiner? This taxpayer's situation is similar to the example provided in Regulation Section 1.446-1E2ib, where it stated that when a taxpayer ceases to deduct items as business expenses, because the items were in fact personal expenses, it is not changing its accounting method. Here, the taxpayer has deducted too many costs and is correcting this error so that it deducts only the proper amount. This change is not an accounting method change. That means it's subject to change in the earliest open year by the IRS agent who's examining the return who requested this internal legal memorandum in the first place. There's not a whole lot to say about our next item except that on November 1st, 2013, the IRS released an updated publication 4483 on maintenance of Section 403B plans, tax sheltered annuity plans for sponsors, explaining common mistakes and how sponsors can avoid those common mistakes, stay in compliance with the law, maximize employees' retirement benefits, and avoid additional taxes and penalties. It's a beautiful multicolor brochure that's available from the Internal Revenue Service as a PDF document. In Gail Jordan et al., Tax Court Summary Opinion 2013-91, the tax court held that two individuals could not deduct expenses relating to a rental property for 2008 because the property was not placed in service in that year. The court concluded that the repairs and expenses were not currently deductible startup expenses that should have been capitalized under Section 195 and found each individual liable for accuracy-related penalties. The taxpayers purchased a single-family house in Virginia on August 25, 2008, proceeded to make repairs of about $3,500 and incurred other expenses of about $6,600 relating to the property, which taxpayer Gail Jordan deducted on her 2008 Schedule E. Her partner, Laura Jarrett, made repairs of $5,000 and reported other expenses of $8,600 relating to the property on her 2008 Schedule E. Now, these ladies owned the property together. They purchased the house with the intent to rent it, but it was never rented at any time during 2008. Apparently, the house was intended to go into the Section 8 rental program, the HUD rental program, but after they bought the house and spent some money, the house failed inspection, and so they were not able to rent it in 2008. Not only was each of these ladies subject to additional tax, they're also subject to the 20% additional tax for an underpayment that is attributable to negligence or disregard of the rules. And I think it's probably worth throwing in here that our observation is, as we've been reading cases now for almost 50 years, it is clear that over the past 4 years, there has been an increasing trend. I think the drumbeat is boom, 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 boom. That is much more rapid, and that the courts are routinely assigning penalties where if there is a deficiency, there's going to be a penalty. It's either going to be an accuracy-related penalty or a negligence penalty. Take your choice. But if you wind up owing the IRS money, there's going to be a 20% addition to the tax. 61 York Acquisition LLC, TC Memo 2013-266. Is another case in which the tax court has disallowed a partnership's claimed charitable contribution deduction for contribution of an easement to an historical preservation organization. In this case, the court found the contribution failed to meet the exclusivity requirement since the restriction on which the easement was granted did not preserve the entire exterior of the structure. The facts in this case are complex. The planners were very sophisticated. The building in question is partially an office building on the lower floors with condominiums upstairs. In wording the various agreements in order to protect the rights of the condominium owners to make changes in case circumstances required it, the partnership gave up too much so that it was not able to grant, in granting its easement, the full control to the charitable organization or the historical preservation organization that was required. This is proof again, and we've talked about it on this program many times, that if you are attempting to claim a charitable contribution deduction for a conservation easement, you should be prepared. The IRS is going to, it's a 100% audit issue. The IRS will audit your position, and if you have not touched every base, you will not score a home run. It's that easy and that difficult. Now we have a 263 Cap A decision, City Lion Candy and Tobacco Corporation, 141 TC number 13. In this decision, the tax court held a corporation operating as a reseller and a wholesale cigarette dealer did not qualify for the small reseller exception of the uniform capitalization rules of Section 263A, and that it must capitalize its New York cigarette tax stamp costs as indirect handling costs rather than deducting them in the year the stamps are purchased. City Lion is a tobacco wholesaler and a licensed cigarette stamping agent for New York. As you know, all cigarettes sold in New York, in fact, all cigarettes sold in any jurisdiction, must bear a tax stamp issued by the controlling jurisdiction. City Lion bought stamps, affixed the stamps to the cigarettes before their resale, and included the cost of stamps in the resale price. On its federal income tax returns, City Lion reported its gross receipts by subtracting the cost of the cigarette tax stamps from the gross receipts it received from cigarette sales. The IRS determined the corporation had underreported its gross receipts and that it was subject to the UNICAP rules of Section 263A with regard to the cost of the stamps. Well, the first problem City Lion had was that it didn't qualify for the small reseller exception because its average annual gross receipts for the three taxable year period ending with the taxable year preceding the year under audit exceeded $10 million if the sales price of the stamps was included in the gross receipts. They were reducing their gross receipts by the cost of the stamps. When the court said you can't do that, that kicked their gross receipts up over $10 million, so the small reseller exception did not apply. Tax court then ruled that the cigarette stamp costs were capitalizable indirect costs incurred as a result of the resale activity, not a tax based on income. The costs were not excludable as a selling expense. The costs had to be treated as a handling cost and capitalized into either cost of goods sold if the cigarettes were gone or inventory if the cigarettes were still on the shelf. No penalty, however, the court did not mention it, so I presume that the IRS did not assess the penalty. There was a legitimate dispute about how the law applied, and in those cases, there's not negligence, and there is not, there would not be an assertion of a significant underpayment. Now we have VECO, V-E-C-O Corporation, 141 TC number 14. In this decision, the tax court ruled a corporation was not entitled to claim accelerated deductions based on an accounting method change, finding that the requirements of the all events test had not been met for some of the deductions the corporation claimed were subject to the all events test, and that the recurring item exception to the general rule of economic performance did not apply to some other deductions that this corporation was very aggressively attempting to claim. VECO, the common parent of an affiliated group that was engaged in various business activities, elected to change its accounting method for prepaid and accrued expenses, which, it reasoned, would allow it to accelerate deductions that it claimed on its return for tax years ending March 31, 2005. On audit, the IRS determined that VECO was not permitted to change its accounting method for those prepaid and accrued expenses, disallowed the deductions because they weren't incurred during the tax year and they didn't clearly reflect income. And it's worth noting here that VECO treated these various expenses as deductions in the year ended March 31, 2005 in its federal income tax return, but was amortizing these amounts in its financial statements, its audited financial statements. And that's one of the things, of course, the IRS looks at. Judge Marvel, writing for the tax court, considering whether VECO, this accrual method taxpayer, met the requirements of the all events test, concluded that they did not. The court agreed with the taxpayer that actual payment isn't necessary to establish whether a liability for an expense is fixed under the all events test, but once the court examined the individual arrangements that VECO was trying to change, the court determined that they were not fixed in accordance with the first requirement of the all events test. Therefore, if the liability is not fixed, then you can't claim the deduction. You haven't met the all events test. As to other deductions, there's one class of deductions that simply didn't meet the all events test. The other class of deductions, the taxpayer was trying to deduct under the economic performance requirement, and the court concluded that economic performance was in fact not met, that the recurring item exception to economic performance did not apply. In order for that exception to apply, the taxpayer was required to show that the disputed items were not material. But the court concluded that the taxpayer failed to show that because the liabilities were prorated over more than a year, they received inconsistent treatment in the financial statements from their tax return treatment, and they were material items for tax purposes as that term is defined under Internal Revenue Code Section 461H3, capital A, small Roman numeral 4-1. And our grand finale this week, another of these just bell ringers of court decisions involving the cleanup of our CPA profession's excesses in promoting tax shelters. I can't recall a more shameful time in the history of any profession, let alone the CPA profession. In any event, a Kentucky court has ordered Grant Thornton to pay William A. Young, Y-U-N-G, and his wife, $100 million in damages for the sale of a tax shelter. This is a Kentucky circuit court. Obviously, the litigation is just beginning. There will be appeals, and they will be expensive, and Grant Thornton's going to be in for a fight. The court ordered accounting firm Grant Thornton to pay a businessman and his family more than $100 million in damages stemming from a leveraged distribution strategy product the firm sold to them, which the IRS determined to be an abusive tax shelter. The businessman's purchase of the product resulted in his payment of millions of dollars in taxes, penalties, and interest that, according to the businessman, and now according to the court, he would not otherwise have been required to pay. Perhaps it will be most helpful to review the testimony of Michael Hammersley, who appeared as an expert witness for the Youngs. In opinion number one, the expert says, the conclusions of the opinion that Grant Thornton provided to Young, they were in the middle of this transaction when the IRS published regulations. It was pretty clear that this is a son of boss variant. It is pretty clear that the son of boss and the bossy variants were in disrepute. Grant Thornton pressed forward with the transaction anyway. So the expert for the plaintiff says, the conclusions of the opinion that was delivered to the taxpayer by Grant Thornton, and by the way, Grant Thornton was unable to deliver a final opinion. They delivered piecemeal, partial opinions just to placate the taxpayer. This whole thing stinks to high heaven from the accountant's point of view. The conclusion of the opinion, conclusions are not accurate because the judicial doctrines, existing judicial doctrines would have collapsed the transaction in any event. Opinion 2. The conclusions in the opinion are not accurate because Code Section 301B2B prior to January 2001 was not unambiguous. Opinion 3. Opinion 3. The conclusions of the opinion are not accurate because Code Section 301B2B resolved any subject to ambiguity through the January 4th, 2001 regulations. Opinion 4. The conclusions of the opinion are not accurate because Grant Thornton failed to properly apply the judicial doctrine. Opinion 5. The conclusions of the opinion are not accurate because Grant Thornton knew or should have known that the Young's business purpose for the transaction was not sufficient to sustain or avoid the application of a judicial doctrine and thus would not have supported the opinion. This is an extraordinarily long opinion. It is an extraordinarily complex opinion. But the direction in which this kind of litigation is going is very clear. The accounting firm that undertakes to sell transactions that can only be sustained if the true facts are hidden from view by obfuscatory tactics is going to expose itself to bad publicity and to significant monetary damages. Well, that's not a happy ending for this week, but in any event, it's an ending. Stay safe.